Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, my dear sweet friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, the Squilix of Podcasting, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. A few weeks ago, I received this audio file from a man in Kentucky.
Dear Duncan, my name is Harry Dexton, and I am sending you this audio file in the hopes that you will have the courage to upload it into your podcast. 2 months ago, while sitting in my backyard, I was witness to a meteor impact in the forest outside my house. A bright light filled the sky, and there was a sound like 1,000 angels screaming in the night. I will never forget the way the meteor sounded when it hit the earth. It sounded like a fist punching a cold steak. I rose from my hammock and ventured into the forest to see if I could discover where the meteor had made its impact. It was not that hard to find where the meteor had made its impact. I only had to go in the opposite direction of the animals that were running from the forest, squealing, howling, barking, and chirping like a great cloud of mammalian terror. They plunged away from me, but I ventured ahead, for a moment forging upstream through a river of terrified fur, until at last I arrived at a smoldering spot in the forest where a crater the size of 3 Volkswagen buses lay. The smell of that smoke was unlike anything that I had ever experienced in my entire life. It was the smell of a demon's breath hot on your back as he impaled you again and again in the lower circles of hell, his eyes rolling backwards in his head as his slavering fangs dripped acidic saliva onto your buttocks, feet, and back. In the middle of the crater, there was something that was clearly an egg, shaped the color of the night sky at dusk. I ventured closer into the impact zone. Having discussed this with my wife, I recognized the terrible mistake that I made. One should never venture into a meteor crater. A scientist should be called immediately. But it was as though that egg had a hypnotic hold over my psyche and I was drawn into it. The very top of the egg could only be compared to the protuberance of a baboon's genitalia. Fleshy and alive, what happened next changed me forever and could potentially change the world. I'm prepared to give you exclusive rights to my story, on the condition that you prove to me that you were to be trusted by playing this first part on your podcast. Once I hear that you have played this part, I will supply the next part of this story, as well as photographic and video evidence if you request. I hope that you will make the right decision. not only your life, but the life of all beings on this earth depend on it.
I know what you guys are thinking. Duncan is putting himself in a great deal of danger by leaking this kind of information out into the world. Some of you are probably thinking I'm doing it for the wrong reasons. You think I'm doing this level of journalism not because I care about getting the truth out there, but because I want to win another Pulitzer Prize. I imagine some of you even think that was my voice in the beginning of the podcast, and that I couldn't come up with an opening monologue or intro, so I just recorded that to fill in some space. You, sir, would be wrong, or madam. That email was sent to me 2 weeks ago with an audio file attached. And if you're out there, friend, I will continue to share your story with the world. All right, we got a great podcast today. We're going to dive right into the interview. But first, some quick business.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Now, everyone, please, open your hearts and send some laser beam level love blasts in the direction of my two great friends and teachers, Saraswati and Raghu Marcus. Welcome back to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, Raghu Marcus. And for the first time, Saraswati Marcus is here with us at the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. Thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, thank you, Duncan. It's great to see you. Good to be with you.
Great to see you, too. We were just having a conversation in the living room about these retreats where you teach yoga at these retreats and how a lot of what I learned from those retreats comes from your yoga class. It's exactly at the same level as when Ram Dass is speaking or Cornfield speaking or any of them. I get my mind blown by your classes. So it is odd that you haven't been on the show yet. Why do I keep having you on, Raghu?
I'm going to give you $200 for that.
Yeah, we'll talk later.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, you know, Ram Dass, I mean, I'm sitting in your space here and I couldn't feel more at home.
You know,
and taken care of, and you know, they've been definitely submerged in these teachings for a long time. And when I teach yoga where we met at the retreat, I really try to think about what could I bring that would companion these, you know, these teachings from people like Jack Kornfield and Ram Dass and Krishna Dass, Mirabai Bush, Trudy Goodman, you know. So I really try to make the yoga integrate into that. So I appreciate that happens for you.
Yeah. I mean, I've had some of the most transcendent experiences of my life in your yoga, just in your yoga class. That's probably just because I'm incredibly out of shape and just need to exercise. So like anytime I'm doing any mild physical exercise, it's like, wow, this feels great. But you have this perfect pairing of the actual yoga itself mixed in with philosophy that It's really interesting because it's, and also you just sort of offhandedly say things like in the last yoga class or the last, in the retreat, you said the spine is the antenna. The spine is an antenna. Do you remember that?
I do.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, what's funny is, you know, I ran into you and you're like, I've been thinking about that thing you said in class. Your spine is an antenna. And I was like, did I say that? Is that something I've ever said or could think about? It took me a minute, you know, because you drop into some kind of flow or stream where you open to a wisdom body channel and things come out, you know, that make sense in that moment. And then, so I didn't even recognize it at first, but then I thought about it a little bit. And what that means is that your spine is an extension, obviously, of the brain, and it's all your central nervous system. And moment by moment, we're making decisions about the degree of our suffering or pain and whether we're going to aim and towards that and compound it, make it worse, or whether we're going to course correct towards something more wholesome and healing and nurturing.
Right.
And we have that opportunity, and those are called, you know, that those opportunities are called, I don't know, awareness or practices or consciousness. And so when you surround yourself with these kinds of images that are here in your space and teachings and, you know, sounds like mantras, I think that helps us.
Right.
To aim in a different direction. So that's how the spine is an antenna. It's reading the environment, feeding back to the brain, and you make a decision. Do I feel safe or do I feel, contracted?
Right. Yeah, that is, I love what you're saying specifically. Well, I love everything you're saying, but one thing I really like about it is that you're pointing in the direction of the idea that we have free will. You're sort of obliterating the possibility of being a victim if your spine is giving you these moments in every second to push in the direction of wholesomeness or to go back into the destructive patterns. If you're saying that we get to decide.
I think we can decide if we know we're doing it. So our level of awareness and consciousness, I'm not sure how much free will we have with that. Maybe there's some predetermined. You know, they say, you know, you've when you're born into a family of yogis, that's a really high birth. And
right.
The rest of us who weren't, who knows how we stumbled onto this kind of material. And often I'll speak to that in a class where there's so many people who never will hear these teachings, ever.
Right.
And to just really take in how rare it is and soak that in.
Free will. That's deep.
Yeah, it's deep.
So from what I've understood over the years, free will is something we need to think we have. And we can go forward because we make choices, as you say. They can be for light or dark. But ultimately, we could never understand the reality of what they call karma and grace. That's one of the biggest things we have. I mean, you've been to a couple of these retreats, right?
Yes.
You see how much the conversation kind of turns into that direction almost at every retreat. And I'm not sure if maybe it's just me. I don't know. I'm super interested in that. I'm super interested because of what was said, you know, by both Neem Karoli Baba, who many of you listeners out there, if you've heard me on Duncan before, you know who I'm talking about, and that he said to Ram Dass one day when he was asked, is karma and grace, are karma and grace the same thing? Meaning, do you have free will, or is it all just, it's all planned? It's all part of a plan that's, everything is absolutely indicated, past, present, and future, and it's all part of that divine intelligence, and really you don't have any, you know, which is a rational way of understanding something that we can't understand. And that's what he said. That's not something I'll talk about publicly.
Wow.
Said, when asked that question. And
that's
then Ram Dass is thinking, gee, why did he say that? And he thought, and he told this to the interpreter, who then said, I must have told Maharaji, Ram Dass is wondering, is it possible that they're not the same? Anyhow, he came back and he said, Ram Dass and I understand each other very well. Mm. So then later on, I actually got a chance to ask my Indian mother about this in particular, who had been with Maharaji for 50, 60 years. And she said, yeah, it's true. You cannot understand that. There's no way any, if you're living in duality, that you shouldn't say it quite like that. You cannot understand that reality. And what we need to do is act as if we have free will. In not so many words.
Well, there's the freedom to be conscious of what you're doing. That seems to be a real... you can actively make that decision to just start following your breath into your nose and out through your nose, and then notice when you get lost. That feels like free will to me.
Could be having the grace to even think about your
right.
breath.
I see. Okay, I see what you're saying. You know the.
You know, this is again. You
I
can't.
Know,
we
I know
can't
it's
understand.
It's a circular it. Conversation.
Yeah. Circular conversation.
It's circular.
Yeah. I remember one thing you said in the yoga class at the spring retreat, which was I think it was a spring retreat. It was one of these retreats. You said the bridge between suffering and grace is surrender. Do you remember saying that?
Mm.
Really cool. And that I love. Lately, especially thinking about the notion of surrender. Mm. And I wonder if you guys could talk a little bit about what it means to you, the idea of surrender. Because many people, when they hear it, that's not a good word.
To say the very least.
Yeah.
Jesus. You want to go for first? Ladies first.
Well, ladies first, that's a whole thing, you know, because that's never
see,
free,
I'm always
you know, ladies first,
trouble.
There's a price tag there, yeah. You know, it's like, okay. You have to be careful, you know, I'm always aware, you know.
On your podcast, you and your listeners are witnessing our dynamics.
Oh, yeah. There is a price tag to ladies first.
Ladies first, or opening the door, paying for dinner, it's not free.
Oh,
so
God.
Just like point your consciousness there, ladies. Hear it.
Oh,
be
God.
Strong.
I've said it. I've said it out loud. I've said it out loud. Like, I pay for everything.
No.
I've said you it haven't. Out loud. Those foul words have come out of my mouth, and I've watched them like some awful verbal flatulence come erupting out of me, just exposing all of my deep vulnerability and manipulative qualities in one terrible, simple sentence.
Do you go, ugh. Why did I... do that
always I'm unfortunately spend a lot of time going why did I do
oh,
that
too, yeah.
I spend a great deal of time doing that but surrender
yeah.
What is it what because you know when you think if you heard we surrendered in Afghanistan not that we're leaving Afghanistan but we surrendered it's like
you know Sharon Salzberg she said at one of these retreats she's like you know well, actually, she said something different, but it reminded me of surrender, which is forgiveness. It's sort of along the same tapestry, I guess, as letting go of something. You're forgiving someone. You're surrendering something that's like causing obstruction. It's leaving residue, you know. You want to be spacious. That's part of why we work with the body and the breath and movement and coordinate all of that is to make space so that something new can emerge. You know, a new thought, a new feeling, a revelation. You have insight, not outsight. But she said about forgiveness, she said, forgiveness doesn't mean amnesia. You know, I loved that. And I think the same is a little bit about surrender. I mean, surrender just means you don't give up, you give up the fight.
Mm.
You know, like you kind of a little bit can be with things as they are, just little by little by little. And that is you know, one way to think about the bridge between suffering and grace is to, you know, sometimes I've described it as bringing in, like, whatever you want to have happen, you know. If you... I remember the last time I gave this example is when my mother was just diagnosed or... she had just had a stroke, and I was really hoping that she would overcome the stroke and heal. And I was causing me a lot of pain and suffering that she had had the stroke, and that then there was me, my attachment to how she healed and all of it. So wanting truly what I want, which was for her to get better, make a full recovery, but also bringing in the opposite, like leaving room for the fact that she's not going to get better. And like, where do we find the place in our body mind to hold both energies? And I think that becomes part of that movement to surrender.
That's a great question, though, that you where do you find the place in your body mind to hold both those energies? And are you supposed to? Holding both those energies, do they just rip you apart? Is it, I mean, isn't there a greater truth happening that it's regardless of whether your mother is sick or well right now, or your friend or your dog or whatever, the big, big reality is no amount of hope is going to keep anyone in this room or listening alive permanently. So does surrender mean maybe just going into that mental space completely, or consciously being aware of the fact that you are a, in the relatively to the span of time, a rapidly decaying cloud of particulates?
That's often I think of myself like that, actually.
Well, more and more lately.
Okay, give me a break.
I'm sorry.
The times are tough. God, getting old sucks.
It does. Yeah. Yeah.
You're doing it well. I mean, you are one of the most strikingly handsome men ever met.
See, this is what you get on the show now.
This is nice.
Great. I'm telling you, though.
Yeah. How long have you guys been married?
I call it, we were struck from bell one, and that's been 8 years in April.
Wow. That's cool.
You were struck from bell one?
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. He actually, when he asked me for my phone number, you know, you put it right in your phone. He, my name was Saraswati, my name was Robin. So he put my name in his phone as Robin Marcus.
Right away. Got married, and that's the end of that.
I was like, oh, you're really into it. You're really into this.
All right, now we're getting too squishy here.
Not too squishy.
Surrender. So the biggest thing about the Indians, like, they have a concept of surrender, the Hindus, especially in bhakti yoga, yoga of devotion, yoga of the heart. They, and we had one friend who's steeped in it, who KK, who you know, and he said to us, you have no idea what that, because the word is so completely destroyed in the West, that word has nothing to do with what we know as surrender. And he went into a whole, I won't get into his, you know, extraordinary definitions, but basically it comes with, it's the last thing before you get fully enlightened, is the way they understand it to be. The last point at which there stops being an I. And so you have acid, right? Best example, if you take a lot of acid, you get to the point where there's no I.
Yes.
Right? And that's when people freak out generally.
Yeah.
Right.
Or right before that point.
Or right before, yeah. And so it's the same. That's the same point, the way I understand it. And once that's gone, then you are fully in what's called in India, Sharanagat. You can go to ramdas.org and find Sharanagat, Sharanagat. And it's the word for surrender. And there's a complete explanation of exactly how to arrive at that on ramdas.org.
Well,
that's kind of groovy.
That's an interesting term. Sharanagat is the word for
surrender.
Surrender.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds a lot prettier, that term. Yeah. We need new words. The words are all gone.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
We have no more words that make any sense anymore. Forgiveness, all these words, all the words that seem to be the recurring symbols that point in the direction of waking up have been so overused that they're just meaningless. And if you spend even the slightest amount of time thinking about, when I think about forgiveness, I will usually get like a negative feeling tone. It's not like I think about forgiveness and I'm like, oh, great. It's usually like, ugh, somebody must have done something fucking horrible to me. And then, you know, like you'll think that.
You got
to
get into it and how are they going to react when you forgive them.
It's so terrible. Heavy and covered in all these like ideas that you learn from when you're a kid and you get into trouble. Or, you know, there's the vision of like some patronizing, pompous enemy being like, I forgive you. But they don't really, they're using the term as a medium to inflict guilt. So that word is kind of a corrupted, polluted word. Surrender, you think of, that means I lost. Yeah. And love, that word is like, who the fuck knows what that means? And you see, we have a red heart symbolizes that. And you put chocolates in it on Valentine's Day. All these words are really, really difficult entryways into the stuff that it seems like they're pointing to. I wish we had a completely new vocabulary. I really
did. You see Interstellar?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you've got to see that. At one point, one of the protagonists, a female scientist, they get into really tough stuff. You got to help me out here, wifey. They get into a really bad situation in space. And they don't know how to get out of this really bad situation. They're having a dialectic, and it's basically about, you know, it's almost science and spirituality.
Well, they're at this moment where they only have enough fuel that you can do one thing or the other. Mm. You know, they can go to this one place that she kind of wants to go, or the other place that actually looks more promising. And they're starting, and somehow they stumble upon the idea. She has a soliloquy where she says, just talks about love being this force that we can't really measure, like an unmeasurable force magic in the universe.
Yeah, the magic that, I think she even said, magic that interconnects everything. Mm. And we just haven't really, we have not done enough science to prove that is what, right? That was what the thing was. So it was actually one of the greatest lines I've heard in a movie in a long time.
But
what love is.
It was Anne Hathaway is the female star. And I felt it was actually like a really great piece that they just needed to insert somewhere. And they're like, let's just have her say it now. It just seemed totally out of left field and had nothing to do with with the movie.
Yeah, but we need new words, that's for sure.
Well, how about this, though? I mean, because I don't have that feeling about the word forgiveness. A mentor of mine would often say, forgive everyone, everything, right now. Like what if we could? Yeah. Like, just that's really powerful. Like, we didn't have to like have all these things clinging to us. Like, can you imagine if you could do that? What would actually drop away? Like all the millions of things weighing us down. I don't know. That's why I'm getting a visual of that.
I love it, but you know? And I have no problem in general forgiving people.
Yeah,
I can really easily forgive people. But forgiving myself, it is impossible. I can't – like I can – if I do something completely ridiculous, something mean – sometimes I get really angry. I'll say awful things. And then I look back at that place, especially from the perspective of what I learned from these retreats, and think, why are you even going to these retreats if that's inside of you? I'm just kidding. But because what I mean is, if you don't, if you're lucky enough, and Chogyam Trungpa says, if you cannot go down the spiritual path, just don't do it, because it really isn't like as pleasant as a lot of people like to say that it is, or like you like to imagine it is, when you see like the image of the Buddha and that beautiful smile on his face and that complete attunement to love, you wouldn't think, oh man, that guy must have gone through some serious shit to get to that place. You just think that's where I'll be. But I don't if you're unconscious and you're just a jerk and you're sort of rampaging through this dimension as a jerk, and there are some real jerks out there, completely unconscious on a rampage. All they think in their life is, man, people are assholes. I'm the Punisher. I got to inflict justice on these sons of bitches as much as I can before I die. And they do that and do that and do that. And they have some weird, miserable death. And that's it. But if you start watching yourself and really contemplating the idea that you do have free will and that you have the ability to open yourself up to this love force, and yet still knowing that noxious stuff comes out of you from time to time, it's incredibly frustrating.
That's the key there. Everybody's got that noxious shit coming out of them. Why are you any different?
Because I want to be better than everyone.
Oh.
But
I don't mean that. That was a cheap attempt at a dumb joke, but please go on, Saraswati. Sorry.
No problem. I remember I was going through a very difficult time, a tremendous disappointment. And I happened to had that experience, like, just imagine a tremendous disappointment. And it really made me question, like, everything I had done, spiritual practices, like, you know, guru, shmuru,
yes.
You know,
yes.
kind of thing. And I was just so, like, ugh. But I also happened to be on my way to Maui, and I got a chance to sit with Ram Dass and share that. And he had such an interesting kind of, thing to say about it. He's like, oh, he's so beautiful. He's like, oh, look what Maharaji's squeezing out of you.
Wow.
Look at that.
That's cool.
Like a purification. It made me, I had a whole different relationship with, like, all of my loss of faith and just scowling. And, you know, if I don't get grace when I want it, then what good is grace?
Right. Yeah, sure.
You know? It's like,
Or for me, the question that comes into my mind after I've thrown my iPad into the wall in a rage is, I think to myself, am I a fraud? Should I stop talking about this stuff until I get to a point where I'm not throwing expensive electronic equipment into the wall of my house? That's where it gets to me, is I think, oh, you don't know anything. You really haven't done the work at all, if you're at a point where you'll get to so angry that you'll destroy an iPad over nothing, over what is ultimately nothing.
Right. This should be, this is a line to hell, actually.
Yeah.
Just get in that line, right?
Yes.
That's where you're at.
That's what it feels
you're
like.
In that line.
It feels like there.
You're the worst person I've ever met. You know what?
What?
This, I'm going to tell everybody what you did. We're at the retreat. We're walking. This retreat, by the way, was at a beautiful cove in Maui. Whales jumping and dolphins and,
you know, turtles.
Turtles. Just a fantastic place. We're chanting every night with Krishnadas, and it's like, you know, wonderful.
Yeah.
Melodies and the rhythms, and you get into a trance, and every day, and it builds up, and all these meditate. You know, it's just the food is great. We're
yes.
hanging out with people. And he says to me, actually, he and I did a podcast, which we haven't done anything with, by the way.
Oh, I was wondering what's going on with that.
And at the retreat. And in it, you talked about Chogyam Trungpa.
Yeah.
Who says, you know, at a certain point, it's easy to grab your new spiritual ego and make that the thing.
Yeah.
And it's like no better than where you were at before, coming completely egocentrically, just from a different platform, basically. Right. Right?
Yes.
And then we walked outside and he says, yeah, like, being in this place is sick. I mean, you know, this restaurant, people are eating daiquiris or daiquiris, whatever the hell they call it.
Daiquiris.
Daiquiris.
I'm like,
wow. I didn't know they had daiquiris.
Yeah. It's kind of
Montreal,
like
it's a neighborhood. People from Montreal, anybody who's listening to this, you'll know what I mean.
Daiquiris, okay.
Daiquiri, yeah.
Daiquiris.
Daiquiri. So, and we're walking along, and the food and everything is fantastic. We are full of shit, aren't we?
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know if those are my exact words.
Something like that.
But yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't say full of shit. It's just this.
We're having a good time, and we should be in you know, wearing cloth of horsehair and being whipped a couple of times.
I don't think we should wear horsehair cloth. I don't. Being whipped can be awesome sometimes, but the essence of the thing is, well, I'm still in the place way before where you're freaking out on the acid, and not where you're suddenly you've had that beautiful
surrender,
that beautiful moment. I remember the quintessential LSD experience, the ultimate LSD experience I ever had was when I was just out of high school. I was sitting on the sofa with a friend listening to, I don't remember if it was classical music, Beethoven or Mozart. I was just listening to the music and listening to the notes. And then I started thinking, oh, these notes. So they came out of someone's mind. You know, this music was in someone's mind. And then I'm listening, and then I started thinking, what part of me is thinking these thoughts? Like, where, if these notes came in someone's mind and I'm thinking about these notes coming in someone's mind, these thoughts have come into my mind. So where are the thoughts coming from? Where are they originating from? And in that moment, man, I had that big acid, like, you're just gone, man. It's glorious. The feeling is exhilarating, expansive, peaceful, wonderful, awesome. But the lead up to that is, it's like flying into a black hole or something. It's just turbulence and insanity. And for me, that translates into I love the Buddhist term fundamental dissatisfaction, mm-hmm. an acute sense of a kind of underlying, undealt with quarry of shit inside of me.
After the experience?
After
you have this go on after you have this Sartori?
I have this experience. I have this the more that I practice mindfulness, the more that I meditate, the more that I go to these retreats, the more I become more acutely aware of this, like, I don't know what you call it.
Is it like a sort of angst?
Yeah, it's just a feeling of like fraudulence, anger, and
how could this be happening when you are who you are? You shouldn't even be listening to this, right? Any of the teachings, reading, you shouldn't be doing it because you're so bad that touching this stuff could dirty it up.
Well, right. Yeah, I know you're joking, but and I know that's what
that's how crazy paying attention to your thoughts. It's just, I mean, you're having fun.
Right.
And it's good, you know.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think what you've said to me pretty often is that you're really enjoying this. You're like digging in, you're feeding your pathology, you know, the part. And we perpetuate our own pathology.
Oh, I see.
You know, same mentor said, you know, you want to get healthy, or maybe we could say, get rid of suffering, change everything you like, you know, just do the opposite of everything you have been doing. And that helps you to
cool.
So it's actually not very, very mysterious.
Right.
So
you're saying that it's just sort of like getting off on the
like, I'm so shit. Used to feeling like, crappy, or in my case, I can turn anything into sadness or
right.
grief. I can turn.
Right.
We were at a beautiful thing yesterday, and it became suddenly all about me and my loss, you know, and had nothing to do with that.
Right.
But that just got
right.
triggered.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and then, you know, I think Krishnadas said something just so beautiful. He can be so staggeringly beautiful sometimes. But he said, you know, we do practices because Maharaji is always there. It's just we're not.
Right.
You know? And so, like, we do these practices to try to be in that field that we can resonate with who we really are, not so much this part that feels like the fraud or feels angry or, you know, not
yeah.
that part. It's
it's daunting, though. I mean, and I don't want to hang out with that part. And I do know, I mean, I am someone who can really get off on, like, being down in the dumps. And there were times in my life where I was really into that. Now I'm at a place I just don't like it. I wish it wasn't. I don't want to be like that. And I don't like it at all.
Here's something you really don't like as well.
What?
I wanted to illustrate, you know, this whole self-reflection of being this horrible person, horrible thoughts, blah, blah, blah. And it's a story of when I was with Maharaji back then. See, Duncan, also in that podcast, didn't we talk about it then? Or we talked about it with Krishnadas. It was that you can't relate to the stories. I wanted to get
to the Maharaji stories.
Yeah, the stories of our experiences with Neem Karoli Baba.
You can't?
No.
Well, no. Here's the thing. It's not that I can't. I have his picture all over my house. It's on every. It's, I have him in a lot of places, and I think about him all the time. And I love him because of you guys and the retreat. That's why I. That's where I feel really connected to whatever that guy was, because I can feel the imprint on you and the people that I've run into there, and it's undeniable. It's real. And so I know that there was something there. I don't know what, but there's something there. You know, on my message board, when people start talking about Neem Karoli Baba, quite often many of them are like, yeah, I don't believe any of the stories of his anything, really. People are quite skeptical. It's hard for people to connect to the notion of a guru. So, and I wish there was another word for Maharaji. I wish there was a way to express that wherever you're at, this fill in the blank, this tendency in the universe for healing to happen, or this.
No, that's
cool. Good.
I mean, when we say Maharaji Neem Karoli, but we could say there are, especially that we knew in the last century, a number of these kinds of beings that were no longer living in duality. They were no I involved with them, and we met a few of them. I can say I legitimately met two of them, Maharaji and a woman saint named Siddha named Ananda Mahima, who's very famous. It's localized in a body while they got a body, but when they don't have one, they're just an extension. They are resting in that place that all these books talk about. Mm. Which is completely at one with what the essence, and we can call it divine intelligence, God, whatever you want. The Buddhists have names for it. Everybody has a different name for it. And that's what this is. It's not, and for us now, although I tell you these stories because I think at times they illustrate something that relates to the present of what we're talking about, in the present. And in this case, it was your reference to how you think of yourself, right?
Yes.
So I was sitting in front, I was about 20, 30 feet in front, I've told this story before, but it's good in this context, on mind rolling. He was asked for these stamps that we all had. We all had somebody had created posted size stamps of Maharaji and sheets and sheets of them. He'd ask for them and you'd give them to him and he'd, instead of giving two to each of the 20 people sitting around, you give them all to the worst jerk you ever saw in your life, you know what? And he asked for them one day, and I was sitting far away, not that far, you know, like 20 feet. I wasn't right up there. And I thought, I've got some, but I don't have that many.
Huh.
So I'm going to rip mine in half. I'll give him half, and I'll keep half.
And that's hilarious.
No problem, right?
Yeah.
So I did that. And it wasn't like he used, you know, omniscient powers. I was right in front of him, and I ripped it. I didn't want to hide anything. I went up and gave it to him. He threw him back at me and screamed at me, "Nay!"
That's hilarious.
No, go away. for 1 week. I don't know if we didn't see him for a week. I was close to suicide. I mean, I really was like, I had to kill myself for being the worst jerk that ever lived, and how in the world I could be in such a... I did what you just talked.
Right.
The story, I told myself that story. I went back there after a week. I still had the stamps. He said, anybody got any stamps? I said, yeah. I got all of them out, and I put them on the bed, on the tucket, on the bench.
Did he keep them?
He didn't say a word to me, right? He didn't look at me. He took them, and he turned the other way, and he gave them all to somebody else.
Right.
And there was nothing. He's talking. And about literally 2 minutes later, he pointed his finger at me and didn't say a word. And that, it's a famous mudra of his, either meaning everything is one or watch out, motherfucker.
Wow.
I got the watch out. So yeah. It was all transparent, and then I could, you know, once you stop being judged by somebody who has nothing going on, that doesn't care about your input, it's a one-way street.
Yeah.
And once you're not judged, you know, and it's a whole other picture.
So this is the, in this kind of yoga where you have a guru, he's sort of embodying like these built-in aspects to all of life, which is that life in general, if you try to rip your stamps in half and save some for yourself and trick life, life inevitably will scream, no, that's for sure. And so they kind of like embody that in their teachings so that you get to experience the very same thing you're going to experience if you're a selfish person. You've been ripping your stamps.
Out of my ignorance, I made that move. It's just completely, obviously, I did it. And I was right in front. It wasn't like, geez, maybe I'll go in the back.
Yeah.
Cut these up in half. He won't know. Which at that point, I couldn't believe he didn't know anything because he knew everything that was going on all the
right.
time. So it was just ignorance. I acted. Okay? You want to talk free will?
Yeah.
That's where it gets interesting. And I got this teaching back that I'm sitting here and we're talking about it today.
Right.
How many, you know, decades later?
Got it. Right. So this is a huge, so it's like you read a book, you could read, I don't know, any kind of child's fable will say share or give or don't give more than you should give even. Whatever. It's like, that's the problem. We've heard it so many goddamn times in so many different ways. Don't hang on to all the stamps. Don't cut the stamps in half. Give everything you can away. We've heard it so many times that it stopped meaning anything. And which is why this teacher function is so important, because they can embody what happens to you in your life if you keep cutting your stamps in half.
And even more, though, is stop having so much self-interest going on relative to judging yourself.
Mm.
I mean, that, you
right.
know, it's
right.
the tremendous self-interest, or what do the Buddhists call it? Self-cherishing. Tremendous.
Selfishness. It's self. Yeah. It's just, right? It's selfish. If you're thinking about, yeah, I'm so angry, and it's a fraud, it's really what you're doing is thinking about yourself.
Exactly. Exactly
well,
that.
I mean, I think it's possibly more insidious than that. It's a habit. And the definition of a habit is something we do unconsciously. So by bringing ourselves into mindfulness more of the time, and mindfulness is, I mean, that's why they say you don't just do mindfulness on the cushion, you do mindfulness while you're doing the dishes and do
yes.
mindfulness, you know, so that you can notice what your experience is and something arising. Oh, something arising. And maybe there's a way you can just zoom out and I love that practice of noticing if something's, oh, is this pleasant or is this unpleasant?
Oh, that's
and
cool.
And like leaving it
at that.
Just that.
So the note, this is like Cornfield's noting idea, which
yes.
is that when a thing arises, you call it anxiety, anger, fear.
And bow to, oh.
And bow to it.
It's really good.
So this is cool because what you're saying, because, you know, quite often I have things emerge in me that I have no idea what the name for the thing is. You know, like he talks about it's like you're sitting in the forest in a rare, and like you're going to watch the woodland animals that usually you don't see because you're scaring them all away. Oh, look, a bird, a coyote. But like when I'm doing this meditation, there's things where it's like, that's something that I don't, that's like something out of a crack underneath the forest that's like got a lot of eyes, and I'm not sure what you'd call it. But this, I love that because then you're not stuck naming, trying to verbalize. It's so much more simple. Pleasant, unpleasant.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And you can do that in any given moment.
You can do that in any given moment.
Yeah.
In fact, I mean, that's a typical step in the mindfulness training is, you know, how to work with thoughts or how to work with emotions and, you know, notice when you get down a groove. Because these grooves, you know, they're inner psyche,
yes.
inner body, and then, you know, and then they're not their beliefs, their thoughts, their, you know, emotions, all of that stuff. And so I think this work with consciousness really does lighten up or kind of that groove.
Yeah.
And we're less inclined to fall into that. So I really, I don't know if you noticed, but I just like, you know, when you were talking about that fraud stuff, you mm-hmm. know, 10 minutes ago or something, it really moved me because I just don't see that person very much at all. I mean, of course, you know, you don't see how I feel on the inside mm. either, but, you know, I see so many other things I would say first before that.
Right.
Before that.
But it's, you know, I like addressing the innate sense of fraudulence that seems to exist. I know it's in me, and I know that it must be in other people too. And the deeper I get into doing sitting meditation and doing mindfulness meditation throughout the day, and the more I do watch things arise, and you get down into the personality, you know, into the sub, you start getting into these weird sub basements of yourself that you didn't even know were there, and all it's like you're, you know, like if you, when you clear a clogged sink, and it's incredible what's down there, especially if it's been a long time since you've cleared the sink, and it, like it's disgusting as you're like pulling hair and you get through that one layer, but then you get underneath the hair and maybe stuff has been down there so long it's just stopped even looking like hair. It's turned into this weird, and it's spit and toothpaste and
like gelatinous,
just
stuff.
Gelatinous gunk.
Yeah, like ugh.
And it's cool though because it's the same thing. Like there's a, you know, zit popping videos on YouTube. There's probably millions of views of people who enjoy watching zits explode out of people's. So,
okay.
But so there's, so it's weird because like you, as you're pulling this, as you're getting into mindfulness and watching, you start getting into these sub basements, and it starts with like, I mean, the other day I was just sitting, I was laying in bed. I'd been meditating, and all of a sudden, I clearly remembered a pottery frog from my grandmother's house when I was six that I was fascinated with. Just a pottery frog. Somehow in the work, that little memory got dislodged from down there and just came floating up into my head. No reason for it to be there. I completely forgot about the frog. It was cool. I mean, I knew it's a vivid thing that you see, you know? You start dislodging all this stuff. And then when you get underneath that place, you begin to get into the inner workings of your personality. The gears, the habitual gears of even what I'm doing now, the way I'm moving my hands and talking and the thing that I'm trying to get at, and I want to get at something, and I guess I really want to get at something. That feels not real. There's an unreal quality to it. It feels, I don't know. I don't know what I would be underneath that, but that part of the thing just seems a little.
That's where Jack talks about it's okay to be human.
Right.
We're okay. Look at us. You know how he goes into that rap? I love it.
Yeah, I love that too.
Yeah, so that's it. You just got to turn. I mean, we do this all the time. It's just turning it around and saying it's okay. You know, we're just human. And, you know, the biggest thing in the Vipassana thing, which is we're talking about what Jack teaches and Sharon Salzberg, people we talk about all the time. And in those courses there for 10 days, you get very deep. And, yeah, it dislodged stuff starts to float to the surface.
Yes.
Some of it's not very pleasant at
right.
all. And that is the nature of the path allowing for the fact that a lot of unpleasantness will have to be gone through. That's certainly the truth. Like in this particular retreat, you know, one retreat, somebody had started to have a toothache, right? And they actually went up to the Goenka, who is teaching, famous Vipassana teacher. He said, just keep sweep. Part of the thing is you sweep through your body with once you have one-pointedness, so you're completely at one with every sensation. And so this guy would get to his tooth, he'd get kind of stuck there. Okay, by the end of the course, they had to take him to the hospital. His jaw was so swollen out that they didn't want to take responsibility for it anymore. So talk about stuff coming up and what happens and how powerful meditation really can be. If you go to one of these 10-day retreats, she's got great stories. You got a nice story.
A lot of people don't know that there is a thing called Vipassana meditation, which I guess is called insight meditation as well.
It's a Pali word for insight. And I think part of that ceramic frog.
Yes.
You know, it's so, and also it's associated with the word mindfulness. They're all related and part of the same tradition. Mm-hmm. And so mindfulness is, this Vipassana mindfulness is either being with your experience, direct experience, exactly as it is. So that's certainly in noticing what's arising, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral.
Yes.
Or creating like a field or that maybe another part of it, another branch, another way to practice is to create a field to submerge into this place where actually you do have insight does bubble up, where you do put two and two together. You have a breakthrough.
Right.
Oh, that's why I'm angry. Oh, that's why I feel fraudulent or blah, you know, whatever like that. And then it's sort of cleared. And so
that's cool.
I kind of, you know, my perspective, I'm a medical person. And so I'm often thinking about health and how these, this conversation, what those touch points are with health and, you know, health, the word, the origin, the etymology, means something like whole, comes from whole. So if we can think about, you know, these experiences, these habits or feeling states that bring us so down, or experiences that we were talking about, regrets and forgiving ourselves and just all of it, just they get pocketed away. Our conscious mind doesn't want to, you know, so all of it's pocketed away,
right,
and fragmenting us. And we wonder why we feel disconnected and like we have to reach to the, you know, the outer world and fill it up with stuff until we realize stuff doesn't do it. And
right.
we start looking inside to find a doorway to this wisdom body that we were talking about on the sofa.
And I love this idea. This, what you're talking about is the other thing that's been coming to my mind. It's a lot of this coming from this Goldstein book you recommended, Raghu. It's so good. But one thing he says is that quite often a human moves to alleviate suffering, where movement itself is to, like, when, you know, you crack your neck or you move your, it's your, you're doing,
you massage something, you touch it and it feels better.
Yes. And the idea is that this action, whatever it is, and a very popular movement these days is to take your phone out of your pocket and stare into it for as long as you possibly can. That's one of the big, big movements of the day. Everyone's making it all day long. Look at the phone. And I think that you can tell the extent of a person's suffering by the number of times they look at a phone in any given minute or 2 minutes or three minutes.
That's probably true.
Because they want to get away. They want to get away so much from this suffering, from this pain, from whatever it is. For me, it might be a feeling of like not accurately representing myself, or it might be a feeling of like anger underneath everything, or underneath that, of course, must just be terror. But when you realize that you are playing video games all the time, not because the video games are fun, but because you don't want to deal with the clogged sink of your heart, or if when you realize that you're looking at your phone all the time, it's not because you're busy or have any interest in communicating with anyone that much that you need to stare at your phone like you're Batman waiting for like word to come in when to save a building from being blown up. When you realize that's all because you are desperately trying to run away from this thing inside of you, it's wonderful, but it definitely will throw your pattern off in a pretty serious way.
Well, I think also, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Raghu, but
no, it's okay.
I think it's important to also, I mean, I find myself saying this all the time because I'm always giving people advice as a medical person. They come in, they ask me, what should I do for this? And I give them advice. But I think the most important thing that we can all do is live with our eyes wide open. It's like, I might choose to marathon whatever series I have left yet to marathon, but I know I'm doing it. It's not like I stop.
What do you mean marathon? What do you mean?
Oh, you know, like if you watch, you know, five episodes of something.
Okay, right.
Or,
right.
You know, listen to five of your podcasts back to back, which I've been known to do also in mind rolling. You know, just like that. But do it with my eyes wide open. Like, I know I'm checking out from something and, you know, or I'm bored or... You know,
boredom.
Boredom.
Now,
you know?
See, boredom. This is what I've been thinking about. It all relates to what we're talking about here. The state of boredom is actually not the state. Boredom is another word for dukkha, isn't it? It's another word for the fundamental dissatisfaction that exists in human experience. And that when you're feeling bored, it's not that you're at lost for things to do.
You're numb.
Are you numb, or is it that you've just been – you don't have anything distracting you from the fact that there's a blistering karmic series of sores inside of you that if you don't put the balm of mindfulness
cankers.
On, you're just cankers. And that this attention and mindfulness seems to be the only thing that has any impact on it. But boredom, is it boredom, or is it just like, oh, shit, I'm not able to ignore the – what this
is. Boredom is people not wanting to just be present and be here in the moment, and we're all suffering.
But I agree with you. I think
lines.
It is an aspect of dukkha. Yeah. I mean, I think that's what you're saying.
I want to go back to fraudulent.
Yes.
I like fraudulent. You know what I think?
What?
I think the thing isn't feeling fraudulent, but not wanting to conceive, perceive, be involved, hear anything that's bullshit. And including whatever comes out of your mind.
That's a great way to put it.
But, you know, I understand that well. And sometimes what can happen, of course, is you can get a little too cynical because you're overly judgmental on everything.
Right.
But I think...
Like him particularly or people?
People in general. No, he does a really good job at it, though.
Of being overly...
Overly judgmental.
It's one of my talents.
Yes. Okay. But, yeah, no, it's common to everybody. You know what happens, though? I think at a certain point, discrimination starts to happen. So you kind of, okay, you know what's bullshit and you know what's not bullshit. Like, go back to this retreat, which is taking place in luxurious circumstances.
Yes.
With incredible teachers, and yet there's always a sense of, like, feeling guilty.
Yes.
That how could we be here getting, is this real or is this just
yes.
bullshit? You know, fun, but there's a discriminating part of you that knows I'm hearing something and I'm feeling something and I'm connecting in a way that I know is completely real.
Yes.
Whatever's happening on the physical plane is obviously a manifestation of God knows what. It sure is nice on that plane.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I am coming here and getting what it is that I need. You know that. That's discrimination. That's right discrimination. It's called in the Indian thing Viveka, and that's a highly important thing to develop. And it takes, you know, it's working. The more you're into your intuitive heart and less in your mind, then the more that you can connect with that, and then the less that you're worried that you're gonna, this is bullshit, I don't know, this is bullshit, you know, the less that starts, stops you. It does not stop you.
Right. Yeah. I probably just misrepresented. I didn't say it in the right. I think the retreats are fantastic. And
no, nothing to do with that.
I think it's great to have them in Hawaii too, because it shows you how powerful the mind is. because that's what I love, like practicing mindfulness in Hawaii and then realizing that you are, that you're the only, you know, people are worried about Fukushima, the water is polluting Hawaii, yeah. But then you realize you have a Fukushima inside of you that's, yeah. And that's the only thing that's tainting the experience is this inability to accept love. That's what you get from those things.
Got it.
That's it. So it's like even the recognition of like, oh, I'm in an active war here. I'm actively fighting off accepting how incredible life can be.
Yeah.
And that is really, it doesn't stop it. Just realizing it doesn't stop it. You're still going to give hugs that aren't as good as they could be. You're still... You know what I mean? You're
fear,
not
fear, just duality, fear, separation.
That's
and that
it.
Kind of brings us back to the beginning of letting go or softening and into
don't want to be weak.
Into something else. The Taoists, and I bring this a lot into yoga, Taoists have a great concept of it's something like you can't be sensitive enough. And like that we thin our skin so much that we can just are connected to each other, that we are part of. Like there's nothing more that separates that. In fact, I mean, all of these wisdom traditions say that, you know, everything's one, but you know, I'm sitting over here, you're sitting over there. So how does that equal one?
Yes.
So that actually the space that is between us gets thinner and thinner and thinner.
Whoa.
I mean, it's just gorgeous, and that we can actually reverse engineer ourselves to that place. We start with the body, lots of practices with the body, hatha yoga, pranayama, so forth, vibration technologies to kind of change, sounding, chanting, all these, change your kind of state of consciousness.
Right.
And then change the mind and change the spirit so that you feel that connection. You have that connection. And then so that sort of loops around into feeling love, like that being, you know, part of the outcome or part of what we tonify or grow at the retreat is we learn to take it.
Yes, that's it.
Can I do a commercial?
Yeah, sure, of course.
A commercial? Well,
yes, for you.
Oh.
Yeah, because you just said this beautiful thing, and really it represents who you are and your work out there, and I thought it was really well said. And so anybody who wants to take part in being able to be part of a retreat or an ongoing teacher training that will teach you just what Saraswati's been talking about, and you absolutely need to go to nourishinglife.com.
Oh, that's cool. Don't, no, Saraswati is making motions not to do that. Well, there you go. Look who's not accepting love. See? It's everyone. Everybody. Active war.
Ya.
Fighting it off. Fighting it off. You don't want it. It's a curious thing. But the older you get, the less, it can be kind of charming or something to be like a, John Wayne style, like, I don't really know, guy or girl. But the older you get, the more you realize this is like putting a tourniquet around my existence and why am I doing it? Why can't I? Because you see at the retreat an entire spectrum of people. You see people who are just accepting the love. They're not thinking, what am I doing in Hawaii? This is, I feel terrible. They're just like, this is awesome. I love this. I get to be here and it's so great and I feel great. You get those people. Then you get people who have gone from being an I and seem to be more of just, they're not, they are the love radiators like Ram Dass, you know, the people who are just really, really just put, you and your yoga class and you, the way you put these whole things together and don't really get any credit for it like you should, and you're assembling the entire thing.
Thank you so much for saying that. It's so true.
Oh, it's amazing. But you just do it. You just do it. So you get people like you are putting out this thing And then many of the people just attending the retreat are just so authentically beautiful, and not in a schlocky, crystal gazing nonsense way, but like you don't want to be out of their presence very long because they're so cool. And like Mirabai, like I'll never forget getting to have dinner with her and just talk. It's not the feeling of like, oh, I am around a truly sacred being. It's like, oh, this is like hanging out with my aunt who I never had. Or this is, I feel like I'm with someone who's in my family. It's the weirdest thing. And so you get this great spectrum. But then somehow in the midst of all that, you realize like, well, I seem to be completely incapable of digesting this or fully embracing it without either, well, I don't know. There's no reason. It's just like, it's a frustration for me. I want to be able to accept it no matter what it is. It's not just the retreat. It's like anything in general. I think so many people, when a thing comes to them that's good, it seems like a trick. It seems like maybe I hang out with too many comedians.
Yeah, I think that's it.
But you guys, there is an active war raging in the world right now. It is the most destructive war that has ever happened. And it's been going on forever. And it's the war where people are trying desperately to not accept love from the rest of the world. And when you find yourself on the wrong side of that war, it's like, fuck, God damn it. I want to be like you guys. I want to be sweet and open and not secretly somewhere inside of me being like, this is all bullshit, right? This is total bullshit. I can't get past that part. I don't think it is. I think it's the greatest thing I've ever come in contact with. But I still can't, like, fully dissolve into it. So, sorry for that long rant. Heal me.
No.
Well, I mean, does it have to be a race? Does there have to be a timeline? You know, and, like, are we measuring, like, well, how legitimate is my spiritual practice today?
Yes.
Is it more than yesterday or less than yesterday? I mean, is it like, you know, why can't it just be what it is, you know?
And just have fun and ignore yourself. That's my recommendation to you. Jeez, I don't even believe this anymore. That, you know, half this stuff.
Just have fun and ignore yourself. Yeah. That is the greatest. That is going to be my new mantra.
It is.
That's so cool.
Okay,
but isn't that bad, Raghu? Isn't
Family Hour sticker?
Just have fun and ignore yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, let's break that sentence down. Just have fun.
Meaning. Don't bother judging anything
of
yourself. Any thought that happens is not worth one extra thought.
What about stop ignoring yourself so that you can actually have fun?
Well, that's the next. The first, you have to stop following the thoughts, and then part of that is just ignoring yourself, following the thoughts.
Oh, I gotcha. So it's not. It's like, okay, the neighbor's got an awful dog. The dog's barking so much that I can't enjoy my day.
Call the police and then ignore your thoughts after that.
right. So it's just like you just sort of deal with the dog. Let's just imagine the dog can't.
Yeah, whatever it is, you got to deal with it.
So ignore the dog.
It's the thoughts. It's
not going away.
The actions.
Right. So you're saying that perhaps the mistake to make would be when these thoughts emerge, because in that mindfulness book, one of the teachers was saying you grab it and pull it to you. Like when the thought comes, you like are like. Which is something I've really been enjoying. I've been enjoying doing it. A thought comes with an associated feeling tone. And then while it's there, as much as I can, I try to like zoom in on it, put it under a microscope. What is it made
of?
You're
doing this?
This is what I've been trying to do. What's it made of? What's the substance of a thought? Does it have a substance?
An interview with Joseph Goldstein, who wrote the book Mindfulness.
I would love that.
Actually, if you could ever get with him and anyone else out there, as a teacher of mindfulness, there isn't any better person in this country. And I would highly suggest Insight Meditation Society, IMS.
Yeah, that book has been blowing my mind.
But yeah, I mean, it just, that's probably not a great thing. You know, there are many different ways to deal with thoughts arising, and the Jax one seems to, might be a little bit better.
I don't know. I like what you're describing, because the thought becomes, it's like a lead or a tentacle that if you follow it back to its root, you might be able to like unhook it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what you're saying is that instead of using the breath or body scan as the focal agent, or the, you know, you're using the thought itself.
Yeah.
So you're gathering your mind around whatever thought is arising,
yes,
and you're really holding that rather than going from thought to thought to thought, or talking more, you
right.
know, you know, having naming. Commentary.
Naming is what.
Naming.
Yeah, naming.
But it's this naming. Oh, here's the thought, or here's the feeling, or whatever it is, and there it is. Peaking, you can watch it, you know, since I've been doing, you know, you guys know this, you watch it emerge, and it really does, like, I've been saying it's like we were snorkeling and we saw a sea turtle sort of go off into the water, and it just goes from being this incredible thing to this dot, and then it's gone. And it seems like these thoughts have the same kind of process or fluctuation to them. But yeah, it's like when the thing comes into me, particularly like anger, when it's there, I try to really like zoom in as far as I can into the, because what is it? I mean, I know it's a neurological, it's some neuroelectrical activity that must be happening in some, it must be inside of my brain. So I think, oh, this is what is this? Is what is that specifically? What is the vibration of a thought or a feeling? What is it at its atomic level? What is that thing? Do you know what it is? Is it? I've heard the term vritti in this Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. This is like a energetic cyclone or something. But is there anything in the scriptures related to, or in the teachings related to, what is the fundamental composition of a feeling or a thought? What's it made of?
I mean, I think that vritti means fluctuation or twisted or, you know, something like that. But in Chinese medicine, I mean, if we can go to that place, you know, each emotion has a different frequency. It has a, just like, you know, it vibrates in a certain way in our body. And, you know, people have different constitutions given, you know, the line of people that they came from. And so once you take a body,
yes,
you know, when you're not in a body, you don't have so much of that. But once you take a body, then you're going to, you know, have all of the whole range of experience with your constitution leaning you off in a particular vibration.
Okay, got it. Yeah,
so like
sure.
that. I mean,
sure.
So that's how we think about it, and then work to antidote that with opposing vibrations or...
Opposing vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
I mean, it's a little more complicated than this moment, but, you know, what I'm talking about is a system of the five elements and figuring out which, you know, is part of what I do and part of what I weave into a yoga practice, actually, is working through the five elements towards that goal of holism, that,
yeah.
you know, that health being whole, being integration, like that. So we work through all the different vibratory experiences, of which emotion is truly a vibration. And just one more quick point, I think it's so interesting, and I love this analogy. The ancient ones would describe emotions, they would equate them to weather patterns.
Hmm.
Like, oh, there's a storm rolling through.
Yes.
And then it's rolling out. Like, it's not me, and it's not of me.
Yeah.
It's a thing that's passing through.
I get that.
I like that.
It
makes
that too.
It, 'cause it's so easy to feel like I am this anger when it's actually just, it's a storm passing through.
Yeah. No, yeah. It
you
feels
know?
Like that. It, when you watch it, it feels exactly like that. And it feels, the other shocking thing I've been getting from this is, how you really start realizing how natural you are. Like, you start realizing how the sound of your, the your breath going in and out of your nose. It sounds like when you're listening to wind coming in on the beach, or when you're in wilderness and like winds rolling through a forest, and then you realize, oh, that is what I am. I'm just a moving version of it. But that's pretty shocking. So I do get why I love that you're using the elements, because that's something that has been coming to me lately. Is it sounds so weird, but how natural of nature that I am. Mm-hmm. And when you're not meditating, or when you're sort of in your head a bunch, you don't even, you feel completely separated from that idea. So, and I know you don't have time to explain it now. We're probably already going over the time that you guys have, but so you would say anger is a fiery feeling, maybe.
It certainly belongs to an aggressive energy.
Right.
We can put it there, and typically anger, resentment, even sometimes depression, you know, like something, energy not moving, or either being stuck, you know, like that, or anger sometimes really moves outward and moves outward fast. So an aggressive, either a blocked energy or an aggressive energy. And so they're very predictable.
So you figure out, is this blocked? Is this what kind of anger is it?
Exactly.
Whoa.
And then we know we can very predictably figure out which energy lines that is, you know, manifesting in.
An energy line in your body?
Yeah, an energy line in your body. And then we give asana and pranayama and sounding. You know, when you make sound like chanting, it sends a vibration. So which chakra, you know, it's all this
that
whole
is
mapping.
So cool.
I think you should take the teacher training program that she's giving.
I would love to. That's really cool. What you're talking about is really cool, man. That is alchemical, heavy alchemical. That's magic. That is like, reminds me of Crowley. It reminds me of, that's high magic that you're talking about there. That's super cool. And so detailed. And this is, where does this come from?
It's Taoist, pretty much.
Whoa.
Taoist. But it's really, it's blended in with yoga. Because I love, you know, I mean, Taoists, they talked a lot about, you know, Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching, the I Ching, all of those works. But what I get from yoga, bhakti yoga, you know, these feeling states, this sort of, I had to combine the two, you know, I had to combine the two. And so that's really where the two traditions, and there's
it's Taoism meets bhakti yoga.
It is. And
that's
hatha yoga.
Badass.
And honestly, a good amount of Buddhist ideology is in there as well.
Whoa, cool.
So it'll be 50 women in the class.
Oh.
And Duncan.
I can't do that.
Have you been investigating this in previous podcasts? Have you been...
This line of...
Yes, this line of...
Well, a little bit. In the one that I did before, a little bit. But I have sort of, after the retreat, I decided that I was going to try to do the work and start a real practice, as opposed to a reading style practice or a contemplation, distant, vague thinking about the stuff you guys talk about once every couple of days. Move that into I'm going to try to sit every day, and then I'm going to, as much as I can, follow my breath throughout the day. And then I've been pulling it off, not completely. I've missed days of meditation, but it's still I haven't made an active intention to like do it.
Have you shared this with your listeners?
I don't know. I don't know if I've sort of, I mean, they're going to, yeah, I don't know that I've completely, I haven't been talking about the fact that I haven't yet to talk about the fact that I've been trying to, I've been trying to accelerate my meditation practice much, but I have been doing that since the retreat.
Walk the talk is what you're.
What's
saying.
That?
Walk the talk. Is
yeah.
That's what you're.
Yeah,
saying.
And move it from the mind into the heart, where it can really, where the transformation really can take place.
That's it. Yeah, and that's it.
And you're all over the spiritual circuit now too. You know that with Tammy Simon, you did a
oh podcast. Yeah, sounds
she's,
true.
Yeah, and she's got a whole thing. It's like couching it, and you're giving specific teachings in this particular thing on Sounds True.
Yeah, you see, that's the problem.
Well, you know what? I don't think it is, because, you know, what you and I, what we talked about just before we started this show was about authenticity and how that there's a place that you can drop into that you don't even like to think about so much. I was talking about that also because I don't remember always what I say when I teach, and that it's like a well.
That's how I know the podcast has been good, is I don't remember what we talked about.
Yeah, so there's like this well, and an authenticity, I think, is you can speak to that really nicely, you know?
Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, the whole tapestry of it. I mean, authenticity doesn't necessarily mean that things always feel good.
You know, as you talk about this, and I agree with you. I think anyone can tune into a higher consciousness, and things can come out of them that are amazing. And if you ask, you know, like if you ask Jimi Hendrix what was happening when he was up there playing guitar, I bet he wouldn't be like, "I'm just really good. I'm just a great, really, really good." Something else is coming through him. Something else is coming through. And God forgive me, please, oh great Lord in heaven and all gods that exist, for ever even remotely comparing myself to Jimi Hendrix. I didn't mean to do that. I just realized I did that. But in a very, very deep, deep, low level, like all beings on earth could tune into this thing and it'll come out of you if you just get out of the way enough. For sure, I believe
that's
that.
What he used to say, by the way.
What?
Exactly that. I don't do anything. I'm just getting out of the way. Anybody who it happens to, that's the only thing.
I just have to say, I saw Jimi Hendrix live. You wouldn't think that.
Yeah,
being
two.
That is so cool.
Kidding, right?
Yeah, well, I think maybe, I'm not quite sure. Early. I was young. Four, maybe.
Four. Right.
But
who
apparently.
Jimi Hendrix at
wow.
Four?
Well, it's because Jimi Hendrix opened for the Monkees.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see the Monkees.
That's, yeah. That's amazing.
Well, you know.
But the so I know about this, but you know the term physician heal thyself? You know
mm-hmm.
that term?
Mm-hmm.
Or something Jesus said is take the. Before you try to get the stick out of your neighbor's eye, take the log out of your eye. And I love talking about this stuff. And I've said before that a lot of what I do, I think, is just regurgitating stuff that I've read. And I think I'm okay at like regurgitation, but I think it'd be really cool to actually have that transformation that it seems like a lot of you have done or and I know there's no spiritual hierarchy and I know we're all the same and I know it's all one. I know. But if you go to the gym enough, you get in shape and it's undeniable that you're in shape. And it's undeniable. So there is a hierarchy in that part of the world, and there is a hierarchy that in comedy, if you go on stage enough, you'll start getting funnier and funnier and funnier. And if you're a painter, if you paint enough, you'll become a better painter. So I think – I don't understand exactly why that wouldn't apply to the concept of meditation as well. So maybe there is a kind of hierarchy. But what I'm saying is it'd be really cool to not be a regurgitator anymore. I would love that, to not just be someone who is vomiting up something that was already good before I ate it mixed in with my
We're
own.
We're against regurgitators. Let's do that too.
What's that?
We're against regurgitators.
Yeah.
We're going to do a whole.
Well, what is it you say, Raghu? You say that you've got part of something like you've gotten really good at thinking less about yourself.
Yeah.
You're the best at it. Obviously. I see that.
Absolutely. I mean, I have gotten over the years certainly less attached to my thoughts, emotions, all of that. I'm not following them the way that I used to. And I'm not using them like, you know, when you get angry, you're talking about angry, which, you know, that happens to me. That's been my biggest bane. We've talked about it before.
Yeah.
And when you get angry, even if it's you're just over something stupid and you're not that angry, you know, your computer did something, and then suddenly you get enraged.
Yes.
You take everything in your whole life and you're going down that path.
Yes.
Of wanting to kill yourself.
Yes.
And anybody around you.
Yes.
Right? that is just supreme indulgence. So after a while, you get that and you don't go down there. You actually just stop. You don't go down
that's
anymore
because so cool.
You know it's okay. That's that bullshit. I'm not going to do
that's
that.
That's just like a crack pipe. That's like taking a hit off of a crack pipe.
Exactly. Yeah. So, so, what you're saying is absolutely right. Practice makes perfect.
Yes.
And when we do that, again, you know, our friend Krishna Das will say
little guy.
Something nice about
it. Well,
he did, you know, of course,
great.
He's great and all.
He's
but
great.
He did say something, and it was about grace. Another shitty word out there, right?
Yes.
Grace is.
Oh, one of the worst.
We got a few. Guru, grace, you know, when surrender. When Ram Dass first came back from India, right, after going there to try and find out what the hell everything was about because acid wasn't doing the total thing. He came back and he said, you know, I'm going to have a hard time. You're going to have a hard time because I'm going to have to talk about several things that are just absolutely unheard of in this lexicon in
right.
the West. Guru, grace, surrender.
Yeah.
Can't talk, you know, of course. And then he went on and talked about him and he talked about him in a way that you get it. Okay. It wasn't about you. It wasn't about you surrendering. It wasn't about you getting grace. You know, that the you was taken out of it as he went through all this stuff. So, you know, I think it's really important to that once you get that, you and you do that. So you can do. There's nothing to do but do this practice. So what he said was, grace is like when it rains. Okay. Grace is cupping your hand. Practice, rather. I'm sorry. Practice is cupping your hands together so you catch the rain.
Wow.
Okay. That's what it is.
That's
and
cool.
If you don't practice, you just get wet.
That's badass. Okay. That's so good.
And that's
good.
How that
is.
Movie ends.
Don't spoil.
Yeah, they can't say how a movie ends.
Spoiler.
Well, it's not a dramatic movie, but I'm saying these cultivating series, and I highly tout them as something else to tell
oh,
you.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Interstellar.
No.
Okay.
Interstellar. This is on ramdass.org, there are three cultivating movies. And the last one was Cultivating Grace and Transforming Suffering. And it really is great. And in that, he really is able in a poetic way, as he, you know.
Krishna Das?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Say what that is. And what you're saying is exactly what it is.
We just had a screening.
There is nothing else to do but practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you can't think you're going to get anywhere. But, of course, just like going to the gym, you're going to get stronger.
But ultimately, I got to say, though, I think you're kind of screwed.
Why?
Because I think we're all screwed. It's like once you turn towards the Dharma and this sort of like occurs to you to be true, like
yeah.
there's something in that direction for me, I don't think you can close the door on it.
You can't.
So,
that,
I mean, in that
me.
Way, yeah. I think you're, you know, I think you're kind of screwed
then
like
we're
that.
Into another word. We have another bad word.
Faith. I'll take it.
Faith. Yeah, faith, another bad word.
You guys, thank you so much. I'm so grateful to get to be friends with you and to have, I just feel so lucky that I get to have this kind of interaction with anybody. So thank you so much because both of you are my teachers for real. And I'm very grateful
to,
no, it isn't. Why do you always fight that?
Because
this is why, you know, this was the same as me, you know,
yeah.
the cutoff, you know, you should take it. And I think you should start talking.
You should slap me around.
Well, I love you guys. And thank you for being on the show. I'm going to have links to your class, links to these videos that you were just talking about and any other, I'll have all ways to contact you on the comment section of this website. And Hare Krishna, thank you so much.
All right, Ram Ram. Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening, pals. That was Raghu Marcus and Saraswati Marcus. You can find out more about Raghu by going to themindpodnetwork.com or by heading over to ramdass.org or by listening to his podcast, Mind Rolling, which is on the Mind Pod Network. And you can find out more about Saraswati by going to nourishinglife.com. Also, a big thank you to Harry's.com. If you go to Harry's and use the coupon code Family Hour, you're going to get $5 off some of the sweetest razors God ever slung down from heaven. If you like this podcast, please give us a nice rating on iTunes. Bookmark our Amazon link and give your dogs more baths than you're giving them. This time we got some great podcasts coming up. Dr. Drew is coming back on the podcast. Maja the White Witch is coming on the podcast. And a great many other fascinating guests are in the queue. Hare Krishna.